Support for The World's Podcast comes from LegalZoom. With over 17 years and more than 2 million customers, LegalZoom provides helpful support, legal advice, and transparency for business owners. More information at LegalZoom.com/world.
Guaido returns today on The World. I'm Marco Werman. The U.S.-backed interim president of Venezuela is back in Caracas. But there's no sign that the country's other president is ready to step down.
The more the U.S. administration will push for a regime change, probably the more Maduro and his entourage will resist.
Also, a group of migrant parents tries to reunite with their kids at the U.S.-Mexico border. One parent still remembers what he was told the last time he was there.
That his son belonged to Trump now, and that parents were going to be deported without their children.
And in Algeria, this is a soundtrack to anti-government protests. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Good to be back with you after 2 weeks away. Also back today, Juan Guaido in Venezuela. Guaido is Venezuela's self-declared acting president, and he'd been out of the country for more than a week. Huge crowds greeted his convoy today as it drove towards the center of Caracas. Guaido had been visiting Latin American countries, seeking their support in his bid to oust Venezuela's other president, Nicolas Maduro. He had threatened Guaido with arrest if he returned, but Guaido defied Maduro. The opposition leader said he and his supporters would not be intimidated. We're staying in the streets, we're staying mobilized, and we're showing our face after a successful international tour, Guaido said today. We're here in Venezuela, we're strong, and we're moving forward. But Venezuela is a divided country, and those divisions run deep, even within families. Mariana Zuniga recently sat down with two brothers on either side of the political divide.
Alejandro and Daniel Rondon are brothers living in Caracas. They're both students. Alejandro is 25 and studies management. Daniel is training to become a chef. But they come from a divided family. This is Alejandro.
On
our mom's side, they are Chavistas.
As in die-hard supporters of the late President Hugo Chavez and his socialist revolution.
But on my dad's side, they are all opposition.
Like his mom, Alejandro is a Chavista. And he says it can get complicated when the family gets together.
We have had discussions at the table where they have offended me. They have made me feel bad just for thinking differently.
One of those opposition supporters is his brother Daniel. He's 22. Daniel and Alejandro were just kids when Chavez took office. They remember going to Chavez rallies with their mom. They didn't understand everything that was going on, but they loved the cheering environment and the energy. It was like a big party. But after Chavez died of cancer in 2013 and Nicolás Maduro took over as president, something began to change for Daniel.
At first, I thought he was going to do things right. But after a few months, I noticed the difference. I didn't agree with the things he was doing.
Things like blaming others for Venezuela's economic disaster instead of fixing it. Daniel thinks Maduro has abandoned Chavez's socialist agenda. For Alejandro, it's different. To him, Chavez gave the poor dignity, improving the quality of life for many Venezuelans, including his family. And Nicolás Maduro is trying to continue that.
Yo en verdad sí apoyo a Nicolás. Sí, es un sujeto que me agrada.
I really support Nicolás. I like the guy. For me, Madurismo doesn't exist. For me, we are all Chavistas.
But many Chavez supporters have given up on Maduro. Years of economic crisis have led to hyperinflation and shortages of cash, medicine, and food. Daniel says the turning point for him was having to line up to buy groceries.
I'm the one in my family who had to stand in line to buy food. Many times there wouldn't be anything on the shelves by the time I got to the front of the line.
The Maduro government blames the shortages on what it calls an economic war, led by the opposition and the private sector, as well as recent U.S. sanctions. In January, opposition leader Juan Guaido declared himself interim president. When Guaido tried to bring humanitarian aid donated by the U.S. and other governments into the country, Maduro blocked it with deadly force. He called it a veiled attempt at a foreign invasion. Alejandro says yes, Venezuela is suffering, but it doesn't need outside help, especially from the U.S.
Hay gente muy mal, pero nosotros tenemos la capacidad de solucionar estos problemas.
There are people in bad shape, but we can solve this problem. For me, this is interventionism. If the United States wants to help us, they can do it in a different way. Obviously, there is some background here. Chavismo always said the United States wants our oil, and it's obvious that it does.
But Daniel says Venezuela is in crisis.
Somos ya un pueblo quebrado.
We are a broken country in many ways. There are people who need surgery, and when they go to the hospital, there are no supplies. We have to go to 20 pharmacies just to find medicine, and then you have to borrow money to pay for it.
This conversation I'm having with them in their mother's house, it's unusual for Daniel and Alejandro. They avoid talking politics, but when they do, they're careful how they speak to each other.
Incluso hemos hablado tranquilamente de política, no.
We have talked quietly about politics. Obviously, we do not agree with our thinking, but always with respect.
Si nos molestamos, pero a pesar de todo, él es mi hermano.
Sometimes we get upset, but at the end of the day, he's my brother.
And they don't want to damage the relationship, so they talk about what they have in common, their passion for soccer. They play on the same amateur team.
No, ahorita tenemos entrenamiento de fútbol.
In fact, right now we have practice.
Sí, ahí sí, somos más que hermanos.
On the field, we are more than brothers.
For the World, Mariana Zúñiga, Caracas.
Venezuelan strongman Nicolás Maduro is known for a certain rigidity in his thinking.
De seguir luchando por Venezuela, de seguir defendiendo nuestra patria, de seguir enfrentando al imperialismo y a Donald Trump.
Imperialism and Trump, the Chavista party line. Tamir Porras has seen a different side of President Maduro.
He wasn't considered to be a ideologue or a radical socialist. On the contrary, he was considered somebody who's used to negotiating and bargaining.
Porras was chief of staff for Maduro back when Maduro was foreign minister in Venezuela. Porras told my colleague Carol Hills that Maduro was known as a dealmaker just a decade ago.
Tamir, I'd like this to be a different sort of interview, one that's less a political debate and more about an understanding of the mindset of one of the key players. Tell us about the Nicolás Maduro you knew in the office every day. I mean, how does he approach a crisis and problems when they come up?
Back then, Maduro was a very skilled politician. He was a trade unionist, no international experience as a diplomat. And he was considered to be a very pragmatic politician, more at the center of the ruling Socialist Party.
Give us an example of how he approached things pragmatically back then.
Having Hugo Chavez as president as his boss and having me as chief of staff, who was a more traditional diplomat, Nicolas Maduro played a role as a political operator. Back then, for instance, one of the strategies of Venezuela was to foster Latin American integration and promote Latin American and Caribbean cooperation. He was extremely effective at getting in touch with heads of state and getting the agreements necessary for those goals to be attained, signed and achieved in a very rapid period of time. Back then, even though there were many leftist governments in Latin America, there were also some conservative governments. For instance, Mr. Piñera, the president of Chile, we had an excellent relation with his government, and we achieved together, for instance, the creation of the Latin American Community of States. The Mexicans, who were also a right-wing government, played a very effective role. And it was also a very different Latin America. There was also a different atmosphere in the region, a more cooperative one. There were, again, leftist and conservative governments that were willing to reach deals and agreements and try to build a common agenda. That has changed ever since. Maduro has changed, but the political conditions in Latin America also have changed. And nowadays, I see a more aggressive, if you will, atmosphere in the region.
What is Nicolas Maduro's background? Who is he? Where does he come from?
He came from what I would describe a lower middle class background. He didn't go to college. Very early after high school, he became the leader of the trade union of the subway of the metro of Caracas, which is, a very large organization. And it was his platform to become a politician, always coming from the left.
You worked with Nicolas Maduro in the early days of Chavismo. Well, how do you believe that he's changed?
In my opinion, the Nicolas Maduro that became the president revealed that he does not have a clear vision for the country. He very much focused on consolidating his power among his own peers in Chavismo, and much less on exercising or implementing, if you will, a strategic vision for the country. And this is the reason probably why his first term delivered practically nothing in terms of public policy, in terms of direction. It was, again, a period where, in my opinion, he revealed a sort of an obsession with consolidating his leadership and his power.
Nicolas Maduro spoke to our BBC colleague Orla Guerin a few weeks ago, and here's what he said.
Listen, Orla, please, it's a war. I pray that God enlightens you. It's a political war of the United States Empire, of the interests of the extreme right that today is governing, of the Ku Klux Klan that rules the White House to take over Venezuela, and they have created a political, communications and diplomatic strategy. They are warmongering in order to take over Venezuela.
Is Nicolas Maduro a sort of true believer in the sort of Fidel Castro mold, or does he have the flexibility of someone who can cut a deal with competing powers?
Of course, he has the flexibility of cutting a deal. And I don't think you need to be a believer in Fidel Castro's vision to criticize the approach of the Trump administration to Venezuela. Again, in an administration that has implemented its Venezuelan policy through John Bolton, one of the authors of the Iraq War. And a lot of spokesmen and women that through the media have been threatening Venezuela with a military intervention. Again, I think it's not about sharing Fidel Castro's or other leaders' vision. It's a very concrete way of addressing the Venezuelan crisis.
I guess what I'm trying to get at is he going to hang in to the very end? Venezuelans are voting with their feet. You know, millions are leaving. It's a crisis. And there's a whole range of reasons why. And yes, there is a U.S. government and other governments are completely against Maduro. But do you see him as somebody who's just going to hang in to the bitter end? Or is he going to leave or cut a deal?
Nicolas Maduro and the opposition will be more likely to cut a deal and sit around the table if and only if the U.S. administration backs off. The more the U.S. administration will push for a regime change, probably the more Maduro and his entourage will resist, and the less likely a negotiation will be.
Can you leave us with one final insight or observation about Nicolas Maduro that would help us understand him?
At the beginning, I remember him saying that being the successor of Hugo Chavez, his mentor and his tutor, was a burden in the sense that he didn't want to be the one to spoil, if you will, the political capital built by Chavez. You know, being the successor, he had to secure that Chavismo would remain a relevant political force and a governing force in Venezuela, and that was a heavy burden. He didn't have, in my opinion, a clear view of what his program and his legacy would be 5 years later. And we have seen it in the last 5 to 6 years, the current state of the Venezuelan society translate that lack of vision.
It's Tamir Portas speaking with my colleague, the world's Carol Hills. Portas was Nicolas Maduro's chief of staff when Maduro was Venezuela's foreign minister. Portas is now a visiting professor at Sciences Politiques in Paris. You're with the world.
The World's podcast is brought to you by Goldman Sachs. For insights from leading thinkers at Goldman Sachs on the state of markets, industries, and the global economy, listen to the podcast Exchanges at Goldman Sachs. You'll hear discussions on a variety of topics from a variety of sectors with far-reaching implications, including global and regional growth forecasts, finding value in today's investing climate, the impact of technology on markets, and much, much more. That's Exchanges at Goldman Sachs, available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and Google Play, and at gs.com/podcast.
I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Last year, thousands of people from Central America tried to enter the U.S. Most were turned back. Not just that, many parents were deported while their kids were kept in U.S. detention. Now 29 of those parents have gotten a second chance to seek asylum. They're also, no surprise, asking to be reunited with their children. Erica Pinheiro is the attorney for the families. She's with the advocacy group Al Otro Lado. Pinheiro watched this past weekend as agents from U.S. Customs and Border Patrol took the parents into custody to begin the asylum process. I asked Pinheiro if these parents might see their children soon.
The first step is getting the parents released from detention. The last thing we want is for the reunification to happen within a family detention center, because those places are prisons and have been shown to be extremely detrimental to the mental health of anyone who's held there. These parents and their children have already been through such an incredible trauma that reunification in a family detention center is really the last thing they need.
Are parents and children in any kind of telephone contact? I mean, do the kids even know that this second chance is happening and that they could be released soon and reunited?
When a child is in Office of Refugee Resettlement custody, the parents are only allowed to talk to them for 10 minutes once a week. So I know that those children have some idea of what's happening, but it might not be as updated as the children who have been released from custody.
Erica, these folks have been turned away at the U.S. border once already and deported without their children. What is the asylum case that they are making to U.S. authorities now? What are you, as their attorney, arguing?
So the first time they came to the United States with their children, they should have been able to present a case for asylum. Unfortunately, almost all of them were deported without ever having access to the U.S. asylum system. So what we're doing is trying to right that legal violation and right that wrong.
So who are your clients? Maybe you can tell us perhaps the story of 31-year-old Jesus, who's hoping to be reunited with his 6-year-old son, Ariel.
Jesus traveled to save his son's life. There were other family members who'd already been killed, and his son escaped Honduras under imminent threat of death. When they got to the U.S. border, agents told them that the law had changed, that his son belonged to Trump now, and that parents were going to be deported without their children. And so Jesus begged to know any information about his son while he was detained. The officers refused to give him any information, and in fact, kept lying to him, saying that in a few days he would see his son, or his son would be on the airplane when he went back to Honduras. When he got to the plane and saw that his son wasn't there, he refused to get on the plane and had to be physically dragged onto the plane.
And Jesus says that when he and his son were separated, his son, Ariel, was literally pulled from his arms. Is that right?
Yes. And that's not the only parent who had their child physically ripped away from them. Now, you can imagine how frightening that is for a 6-year-old to be physically torn from his father's arms by men with guns.
Well, let's go back to last summer, because the Trump administration was getting a lot of heat for its child separation policy. Here's what then Attorney General Jeff Sessions had to say about it.
If you are smuggling a child, then we will prosecute you. And that child may be separated from you as required by law.
Erica, it is hard to believe the separation, as horrible as it must be, was a surprise to a lot of these parents. Had they not heard the stories from others who had made the crossing that their children would be taken away?
These people were fleeing for their lives. It wasn't like they were sitting comfortably in a hotel watching television. They were literally in hiding, moving through multiple countries in order to seek safety in the United States. Also, it was the U.S. government, not the parents, who broke the law. It is legal to seek asylum, whether you present yourself at a port of entry or cross the border without authorization.
So what is the way forward for these families? Do they have, in your opinion, a good shot at getting asylum right now and being reunited?
We anticipate that at least some of the parents will be released in the next few days. Unfortunately, we believe that some may be detained for weeks or even months while they process their asylum claims. It makes a huge difference for people to have legal counsel. We are either representing the parents ourselves or connecting them with pro bono counsel. So we are confident that all will eventually prevail on their asylum claims.
Well, that is hopeful news. Erica Pinheiro, an attorney with the immigration advocacy group Al Otro Lado. She's representing 29 Central American immigrant families who are hoping to be reunited with the children they were separated from at the border last year. Thank you very much, Erica.
Thanks for having me.
We reached out to Immigration and Customs Enforcement and did not receive a statement in time for our broadcast. You may have heard about the separatist movement in Quebec. The idea was really active back in 1995 when there was a referendum on whether the province should secede from Canada. Well, now there's a group of people in Western Canada who also want to secede. Prairie Freedom Movement spokesperson Peter Downing joins us from Edmonton, Alberta. I'm looking at a big map of Canada, Peter, and Alberta is over there on next to British Columbia in the far west, and then next to Alberta, Saskatchewan, kind of a big rectangle. Alberta's kind of Nevada stretched out. For people who've never been to the Prairie Provinces of Western Canada, what is it like to live up there?
It's good. I'm from Southern Ontario, originally near Toronto, and I moved out west when I joined the Mounted Police, the guys with the red suits. So I came out here, and the culture is a little bit different. You know, it's a little bit more laid back, really hardworking, decent people working 80 hours a week in various energy sectors. We work hard for ourselves, and we don't take other people's stuff. And we're seeing a lot of our wealth. It goes towards the eastern part of the country, to Ontario and Quebec being the big ones who kind of dominate Confederation, so to speak.
But that's the point, isn't it? You're part of the Canadian Confederation. So why should Alberta, Saskatchewan, and other parts of Western Canada be granted independence? I mean, that's part of the deal,
so
I can, right?
So if you go back to the 1990s with Quebec, if you follow the referendum, the separation movement out there, they were unsuccessful. It was a very narrow margin. It was just over 50% voted to stay. But after that, there was a Supreme Court decision. And then the Clarity Act of 2000, which was an act of parliament, laid down the rules by which a province can leave the country. And part of that is having a very clear referendum question. And then secondly, having a clear majority of people vote yes, kind of like Brexit.
You really want to compare yourselves to Brexit? I mean, that's a very bad comparison these days.
Well, if you look at the motive for leaving, there's more reasons for us to leave Canada than there were for the British to leave the European Union. Now, anybody can look at the mess that's turned into and learn some lessons and what to avoid. And again, our separation and our move for separation and a referendum on separation from the current Confederation system is not based on any kind of national identity, cultural identity, anything like that. It really is us being milked dry by Eastern Canada and having our backs turned on us by the eastern part of the country.
The population in Alberta and Saskatchewan is relatively small compared to other provinces in Canada. How do you respond to the argument that in a republic, it's about proportional representation and that's just a reality you have to live with?
Well, I think that's a very expensive argument when home ownership is a long way off for a lot of our young people. 50 years ago, it wasn't. We have very highly educated, hardworking young people who home ownership and their hopes and dreams are a long way off. When you talk about issues of proportional representation, I think when it comes down to 20,000 people being out of work in 1 month, I think it's a fuzzy sentiment.
Peter Downing, the spokesperson for the Prairie Freedom Movement, advocating for secession of Canada's prairie provinces. Thank you very much, Peter. Appreciate your time.
Have a great day. Bye. Thank you.
This is The World and theworld.org. I'm Marco Werman. Science fiction from China is getting a lot of attention in the U.S. lately, and Ken Liu deserves some credit for that. He was one of the first to translate Chinese sci-fi into English.
You know, if I can bring more of my friend's work into English to share with fellow Anglophone fans, that's really cool.
That story still ahead here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. It's been exactly 1 year since a former Russian spy and his daughter were poisoned with the nerve agent Novichok. That was in Salisbury, England, as you recall. Three suspects have been identified in the attempted assassination, and they've all been linked to the Russian military intelligence agency known as the GRU. Uncovering the identities of the suspects, that was not done by authorities, but by independent investigators. Roman Dobrokhotov is one of them. He's in Moscow, where he runs the investigative news site The Insider, and he's been working with another group of researchers who run the Bellingcat website on the Skripal case and other cases, too.
As we understand, there were four agents actually involved. Now we're looking for the fourth guy. We hope we'll find him because we already suspect some GRU officers. And that will be actually the end of our investigation on Salisbury. That doesn't mean that it will be an end of our investigation overall, because we already seen their activity in many other European countries. So I think it's only a beginning, actually.
Are you just really good at your job, Roman, or are the Russians sloppy at theirs?
I think they're really making very, very stupid mistakes. For example, when we were investigating Montenegro case, where two GRU agents were organizing a coup d'etat to change the position of the country about NATO.
What year was that case?
2016. So not very long time ago.
Yeah.
So we found that they were sending money to Serbian military guys who were supposed to start this coup d'etat. And they did it through Western Union. And this GRU agent, he put his name into the check of this Western Union transfer and put the address of headquarters of GRU, right?
You're kidding. This is the most stupid thing.
I'm not kidding. This is now a part of official investigation in Montenegro. This document is now one of the main proof that they were involved. So this is the most stupid thing that you can do in your life, right? And also recently there was a case in Netherlands when they caught Russian hackers, also from GRU, and one of them had in his pocket a ticket from taxi, again from one of the GRU offices to airport. Also very stupid to have it with yourself when you go to an operation, right?
Yeah,
and there are
it's
some...
kind of extraordinary. I'm no
spy,
but
it doesn't look like we used to see in this whole series, like, I don't know, Homeland on the Americans, etc.
Right.
But it is not very. That's not very surprising when your government is corrupted and not very efficient. You can't work as like in a Hollywood movie, right?
How did you get into this work in the first place, Roman?
There are not many people now in Russia who want to do this job. That's the problem. So they don't even try.
And the reason they don't want to do the job, I suspect, is because there's a lot of risk that goes with it. I mean, have you faced any reprisals from the Russian government?
So we didn't see any problems for now. That doesn't mean that this is not risky. I think the explanation is that we are now in the middle of attention and they think that, like, it's too late to put some pressure on these guys and it will create a very bad noise. So that's why maybe we are now a little bit in safe position, at least for some time.
Do you feel you have the support of Russians who feel like mainstream media in Russia is not providing what they need to know?
Yeah, well, Russia is a divided country. So I think there is like 30% of population who really support Putin, 30% of population who are really against. And among these 30% who are against, of course, for them, this information was extremely important because that gives them explanation of what's going on. For those 30 who support Putin, they just ignore it. They don't believe it. It's like with Trump supporters, for example. But I think there are more and more people who really listen to independent media more attentively recently.
Roman, as for the risks you're taking, we know the record of journalists who criticize Putin on toxic subjects. Some of them have died under mysterious circumstances and sometimes not so mysterious circumstances. You said that the odds of death and risk generally is less for you than for your grandfather who fought for the Soviets in World War II. He fought the Nazis to defend the Soviet Republic. So who are you fighting for?
Yeah, so it's, I think you have always to compare it with something. So if you will compare ourselves with the people who also fought for the freedom of our country, like our grandfathers, our risks, of course, are much less, because every third soldier didn't return from the war.
Right.
And still they volunteered. Like one of my grandfathers, he was too young to go, but he volunteered. In this situation, when the freedom of our country is on stake, it's not what we should be afraid. We see that we are sliding back into a totalitarian country. Right now, every year we see more independent media closed, human rights watchers arrested, journalists that have to flee the country, activists arrested, even just people who share something in Facebook can have sometimes a legal trial and be in prison for 5 years. So that's what we are fighting for. We are fighting for rule of law and for democracy. Because when we explain what's going on in the country, explain about all these crimes made by all these Giru agents or Russian corrupted officials who are linked with mafia, when we explain it all to Russian citizens, we weaponize them, we empower them to change the situation.
Roman Dobrokhotov runs the investigative news site The Insider. You can find Wired Magazine's in-depth profile of Dobrokhotov pinned on our Twitter profile. We're at PRI The World. Well, here's a fun fact. Only about 3% of all the books available here in the U.S. are translated from other languages. And in that tiny slice of literature, we've been seeing a lot more of one kind of book recently, Chinese sci-fi. The genre is having a moment here in the U.S., and there are signs that Chinese sci-fi is about to make it big in other countries. The World's Lydia Emanalidou reports.
If you're a science fiction or fantasy nerd like me, you might have heard of ReaderCon. It's an annual literary conference that happens here in the Boston area. I was there a few months ago, and that's where I met Neil Clark, publisher of the monthly sci-fi magazine Clark's World.
We're surrounded by books. We're in the book room.
Clark is sitting behind his little book stand, surrounded by stacks of magazines and books he's brought here to sell. He points out examples of Chinese sci-fi in translation, a couple novels, anthologies of short fiction, and then there are the translated stories that he's been featuring in his own magazine.
On the front row of the table are the last 12 issues we've published of the magazine, and there's one in every one of those.
Translated work, let alone work from China, is not something you would have found here 5-10 years ago, Clark tells me, but things have changed.
In some ways, it's almost like we woke up, because they've been doing this for a while. It's just we haven't seen the stories.
Scholars trace the origins of modern Chinese sci-fi to the beginning of the 20th century, about 50 years before communism came to China and the People's Republic was established. China was on its last dynasty, and a revolution was brewing. The Qing dynasty, people felt, had failed them, failed to modernize China and to guard against foreign powers. Xia Jia is a sci-fi author and a professor of Chinese literature at Xi'an Jiao Tong University. In those early days, she says, Chinese sci-fi was mostly a utopian vision of what China could become.
You can see that at that time, most of the stories are just like imagination about a new China in the future. And they just imagine that China can be more powerful, more developed, more modern.
Over the next century, Chinese sci-fi took many different forms and shapes. There were periods when the Chinese government embraced its idealism and packaged it into propaganda. At other points, it was suppressed, seen as a foreign influencer that was polluting Chinese culture. By the early 2000s, homegrown science fiction was really only popular in niche circles in China.
I remember that in 2006, I was interviewed by a journalist, and she wanted to write a report entitled Does Science Fiction Die in China?
It certainly seemed like it might have died, but actually it hadn't. There were sci-fi writers. It's just that few people were paying attention to their work. Ken Liu was one of those people. He's a writer and a computer programmer and a lawyer based here in the U.S.
My thought was just, this is so cool. I'm reading a lot of great stories that are really interesting.
There were stories about global warming, social inequality, technological advancements, things you would expect to find in any sci-fi. But in some ways, the work was also uniquely Chinese.
The basic conflict, if there's anything unique about China, it's this. China has undergone modernization in the last 3 decades that took the West something like 300 years to go through.
The sci-fi writers that Ken Liu read expressed concern about things spinning out of control, too much change happening too fast, economic and social gaps in China getting wider and wider. Ken Liu was a big fan of the work he was seeing coming out of China. So he thought, what if I translated it? He didn't have any formal training in translation. Still, the first story he ever translated landed him and its Chinese author a small award here in the U.S. in 2012.
And so I was like, oh, this is kind of cool. You know, if I can bring more of my friend's work into English to share with fellow Anglophone fans, that's really cool.
Over time, Ken Liu brought dozens of stories and novels to the U.S. The recognition the work was getting here started having an impact for writers back in China, writers like Tang Fei. We spoke over the phone recently, and her friend translated for us. She told me that back in 2013, Ken Liu translated one of her stories, Call Girl, and helped her get it published here in the U.S.
She thinks that it helps a lot in terms of how readers and critics in China see her work. And recently, she just got her first short story collection published in China. So she thinks that it's important to have your stories translated.
It was only after she got published in the U.S. that those stories started appearing in China. Other writers who had similar experiences told me they find this problematic, that it takes getting attention in the West for their work to be recognized back home. But Tang Fei told me she doesn't mind. Of course, it took a lot more than just a translator to elevate the profile of an entire genre. The stories were really good. And there's also the fact that more people are paying attention to China and its technological ambitions as it vies to become a world superpower. But ask anyone in the know about Chinese sci-fi and they'll tell you. Ken Liu was a key figure, the key figure in this story, a story that had its biggest moment in 2015.
Thank you, and welcome to the 2015 Hugo Awards Ceremony.
Think of the Hugos like the Oscars, but for sci-fi and fantasy literature. A translated Chinese science fiction novel called The Three-Body Problem was up for the biggest award. Best novel. It was written by China's Liu Cixin, translated by Ken Liu. And it tells the story of humanity's potentially dooming encounter with an alien civilization.
And Hugo goes to The Three-Body Problem.
This was a big deal. It was the first time a translated book ever won the award. It drove up sales not just in the U.S., but also in China.
That's the real turning point for making Chinese science fiction a big thing, both in China and internationally.
Regina Kanyu Wang is with a company called Storycom. It's based in Beijing, and it finds and commercializes Chinese sci-fi. She told me that an entire industry has popped up in China to bank on the sci-fi craze.
We think science fiction will be the future popular genre in not only literature, but also movies, games, and other media platforms.
The real test for Chinese sci-fi, Wang told me, will come down to one thing, films. Last month, China released its first ever big sci-fi production. It's called The Wandering Earth. It started out as a novel written by Liu Cixin, the writer of the Three-Body Problem trilogy. The plot goes something like this. The sun is rapidly expanding and is about to engulf the Earth. A newly formed global government is on a rescue mission to propel the Earth out of the solar system and humanity to safety. Spoiler alert, it's ultimately China that saves the world. So far, The movie is a hit in China. And Netflix recently announced it bought the rights to stream it. All promising signs that Chinese sci-fi is here to stay. For The World, I'm Lydia Manolidou.
Earlier this hour, we heard from investigative journalist Roman Dobrokhotov. One thing that sticks with me from that interview is that the tools for activism online are seemingly limitless. And that's true for our next guest, Esra Al-Shafei. She's a human rights activist in Bahrain, and she's been building online platforms and tools with the organization Majal. One of the platforms Al-Shafei built is called crowdvoice.org. It's a site that people can use to verify events and information around the world.
It was really an epiphany because at that time, I spent 3 to 4 years working in online advocacy. I had my own organization, of course, living in Bahrain, surrounded by many injustices. And the frustrating thing is that we just had a really hard time compiling and curating information effectively. So when we communicate with each other, it was always through insecure means, email, sending each other videos, pictures. And then we realized we're only listening to about 5% of the story and only have an access to, you know, 10 to 15% of the available content out there. We didn't have access to resources, to money, to journalists, to media entities that could come and verify pieces of evidence. That's what made me create CrowdVoice. And we had no idea it would actually be as global as it is. And the fact that it would be mostly used in places like India and Mexico to talk about journalists, to talk about elections, to talk about missing students and disappearances and immigration issues, that just inspired us just to continue expanding the platform and, you know, introducing new features.
And what do activists actually do with that information and data?
They often share it with other journalists. So, for example, I will use my personal case study. So I was collecting a lot of information about the abuse of migrant workers in Bahrain, and a lot of journalists didn't have access to data. And the reason was that they were often denied visas to enter the country because they couldn't report about these issues on the ground. So they would often, I wouldn't say deny that these issues take place, but they would ignore it because they say, well, the information is not out there, so we simply can't report it. And so I created CrowdVoice really to collect a lot of evidence, videos of abuse, videos of women in shelters, videos of, you know, people pleading with their embassies to be being sent back to their countries of origin and being denied. So people stuck here for as much as 20 years because of debt. And when the journalist says, well, how do we verify it? We say, well, it's crowdsourced. It's crowdsourced verification. So let's say, for example, I start a topic about migrant workers in Bahrain, but one of the videos is actually about a migrant worker in Saudi Arabia. It's relevant, but it's not totally accurate because the journalist wants to write just about Bahrain.
Well, I was going to ask you, because there is this enhanced fear of bots and fake news everywhere, really.
Yeah.
How do you take on that?
It's 100% human moderated. So we don't use – the only thing we use bots for is the back-end algorithm that collects this information automatically. But then a human moderator has to go to that back-end and verify and say, yes, this is true. And it doesn't mean that it's true. So another person can come and say up-thumb-dipped or gave it a thumbs up, which basically means, you know, it goes into the public stream. Somebody else can say, no, this is actually not true. This protest did not take place in Saudi Arabia. This protest took place, for example, in Qatar or Yemen or the UAE. So that's really has been the only way we could do it because we don't have resources. So the thing is we really wanted to develop a platform that worked for our needs, at the same time was as verifiable as we can possibly have it be. We rely entirely on the goodwill of the users. And it has, for the most part, worked really well for us.
Esra, your organization, Majal, has also created a platform called Mideast Tunes. What is that used for? I mean, like, how much musical activist content is there in the Mideast these days?
You know, Majal focuses on two goals, which is freedom of expression and access to information. And Mideast Tunes, I feel, best puts these goals together. It does it very creatively because it's much more difficult to censor music. I really wanted to curate all of this information in one place and have it be readily accessible to people from throughout the region. And we started out, again, very small. We focus exclusively on the Gulf, Bahrain, Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, were But we saw an incredible amount of interest from Palestinian musicians, from Lebanese independent musicians, from a lot of women hip-hop artists in places like Egypt and Morocco and Tunis, and it just started expanding. And now we have more than 2,000 artists, the majority of whom are also using music to express political dissent. That's our only way of listening to their stories and amplifying their voices.
So I don't know if you've encountered this with either crowdvoice.org or MideastTunes.org, but there does seem to be kind of almost a short attention span with digital activism. You know, one day there's a hashtag and then people kind of forget about it. Do you encounter this? And what do you do about
it? We encounter it all the time. We have to be incredibly consistent about the effort. There's going to be 10 months where people don't care about anything you produce or anything you share. They're not going to respond to emails. They're not going to help you fundraise. They're not going to support you in any way. And it just means that we have to adapt to the world. It took a long time for us to be where we are today. And it took a long time also for us to understand the power of decentralizing the web.
Esra Al-Shafei, human rights activist and founder of the organization Majal in Bahrain. Thanks very much. Great to meet you.
Thank you so much.
Musical activism has been alive in Algeria recently. And this has been the main soundtrack. Moltini is the title of the song. It sounds patriotic. Because it is. Moltini means my homeland in Arabic. The lyrics talk about the idea of give me freedom or give me death.
Moltini is a poem from the 1930s by a Palestinian poet named Ibrahim Toukan.
That's Nasser Widadi. He follows youth and social movements in the Mideast and North Africa.
It has become, over the years, the unofficial anthem of the Palestinian people, and then the new Iraqi anthem after the fall of Saddam Hussein. Throughout the years, it has been adopted by the youth because the lyrics are about patriotism, about freedom, and about renewal.
Patriotism, freedom, and renewal. Big themes for youth in Algeria right now. For nearly 2 weeks, Algerians have been in the streets, angry that President Abdelaziz Bouteflika wants an unprecedented fifth term in office. He's 82, rarely appears in public, and his health is not good. Last night in Algiers, the protests grew larger. And if you were there, you would have heard people singing Moltini.
Moltini comes in as a new anthem for them that they all agree on, that sort of articulates the vision and the demands for a younger Algeria to take over.
We leave you with this heartfelt rendition of Moltini by the famous Lebanese singer Elisa. She covered the song in 2015.
Moltini. الشباب لن يكل همه وان يستقل.
The World comes to you from the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. We're back with you tomorrow.